This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 14th of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 105th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Right, we're busy, cats. Let's rattle off what's going down this week. I've been in Doha for Qatar's big week of gallery and museum openings. We investigate the Hajj and meet Damien Hirst in the desert.
I put an outdoor sculpture into Devon, which is a big pregnant lady. And as the first day when I went to look at it, there were loads of people around it. And there was like a 14-year-old girl stood there. And just as I went past, I just heard her saying, "Oh my God, that's disgusting."
Last week also saw the world's premier gathering of TV types in Cannes for MIPCOM. What were the hot formats? What will we be glued to? Broadcasts Peter White knows.
It certainly looks to be that television has taken over the impetus of film, and you're going to start getting people that would have maybe made movies now making TV shows.
And we speak to James Brabazon and Sebastian Junger, friends of photojournalist Tim Hetherington, tragically killed at work in Libya in 2011. They've made a film about Hetherington, titled Which Way is the Front Line from Here?
What Tim's interested in is the software of war, not the pornography of war. He's interested in the people who fight, why they fight, and how it affects them.
Plus, this week's Midori House session comes courtesy of Lebanon's finest, Mashrou Leila. We'll get a taste of the Nouveau Cinema Festival in Montreal and hear what happened when Flip Brazil came over to the UK. That's about books, by the way. That's all here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. So right on cue, it's time for the first taster of this week's Midori House session. No culture show would be complete without it, and this week it's a corker. Mashrou Leila is a Lebanese seven-member alternative rock band from Beirut. Led by frontman and co-founder Hamad Sino, the band has released three studio albums while causing many controversies due to their satirical lyrics and themes. They came into Midori House to play us some tracks from their new album, Rasuk. First up, here they are with Skanda Mahlouf.
I'm
That was Mashru Leila with Skandar Maluf. We'll be having a chat with their frontman, Hamed Sino, and some more tracks from that fabulous session a little later on in the show. You're listening to Culture on Monocle 24, and we move east from Lebanon now to the desert climes of Qatar. The oil-rich Gulf state is becoming a powerful force in the art world and the art market, with its pockets as deep as an oil well and its acquisitive nature. Under the guidance of the Emir of Qatar and the young, cool and artistically inclined Sheikha Mayassa, huge cultural projects have been realised. Others are still works in progress. With an emphasis on education and a bit of sharing the love, Qatar teamed up with the UK on its cultural projects this year, for example. Doha is home to some mighty impressive museums and galleries. I flew out last week to tread some red carpet at the openings of its autumn exhibitions and caught up with the undoubted star of the show, Damien Hirst, who had not one, but two openings in Doha last week. First on the list, though, was a visit to the Museum of Islamic Art, the building they lured I.M. Pai out of retirement to draft. It's the loveliest building in Qatar, a sturdy yet elegant mirage on the waterfront that houses a beautiful and priceless permanent collection, as well as showing from this week onward Hajj, The Journey Through Art, an exhibition of artefacts, photographs and ephemera that trace not just the spiritual aspect of the pilgrimage, but its economic benefit to Mecca and highlight some wonderfully naff souvenirs in with the piety. I spoke to the show's curator, Dr. Munia Shekab Abudaya.
The idea actually was to give more information about what has been created around the pilgrimage and what has been an inspiration for contemporary artists as well. I think it's going to be interesting even for people who went on Hajj, but as well for non-Muslims, for any kind of audience. I think they might be interested by any aspect of this exhibition, and this is why we really wanted to make it wider. We wanted to build it as an exhibition for any kind of audience.
I wonder whether Muslim contemporary artists, whether you're interested in the way that they engage with it, because it's a religious and an artistic endeavour for them both, isn't it? Do you think there's a conflict there in any way?
Well, the thing is that I can't speak really on behalf of the artists themselves. I guess that they have really personal way of seeing the Hajj, and maybe they want to show a very precise aspect of it. I think what we really want to show here is how they can be inspired and what they can create around that, much more than how is it conflictual for them, or I think this is more like personal for them. And of course we're not here to show any of their personal thoughts about Hajj.
And it's interesting that one of the first rooms in the exhibition is about Mecca as a city, as a town where things happen other than Hajj, the economic and the social side of Mecca. That's quite an interesting thing to do. It's a nice direction to take the show in. Was that something that you came up with and you wanted to show it as a human place as much as a religious place?
Yes, I really wanted to show Mecca other than the holy place where people go 5 days a year to perform the Hajj. Mecca has always been, even before Islam, an important place, a historical place where coins have been minted, where manuscripts have been produced, and it's an economic place as well. And so it's a living place. So I think it was important to introduce the visitors to this idea more than introducing only about the Hajj. It's also about the place where the Hajj is performed every year.
And, of course, there's some beautiful ancient manuscripts. There's the receipt that you told us about, or the proof of having gone to Hajj. There's some beautiful decorations as well from the Kaaba. And there's also some really nice, tatty, modern, contemporary souvenirs. As a curator, it must have been nice to get your hands dirty with some of this this contemporary, plasticky stuff as well, right?
Yeah, I think this is really the part where I wanted to get through this exhibition, because I think that Hajj is such a lively experience, and it's still performed nowadays. It should have been like that, just mixing everything all together, showing artworks, contemporary artworks, showing modern souvenirs just next to historical ones. I think it's something extremely important.
That was me talking to Dr. Munia Shekab Abudaya, curator of Hajj, The Journey Through Art, on at the Museum of Islamic Art in Doha. Later in the week, things got a bit more contemporary. In fact, a lot more. Damien Hirst bestrode Doha like an art colossus with two big openings. The first was the unveiling of The Miraculous Journey, 14 huge bronzes that depict the genesis of human life from nothing to baby, and they sit aptly just in front of Doha's yet-to-be-completed Sidra Maternity Hospital. Opening night sounded like this. فكسونا العظام لحما ثم أنشأناه خلقا آخر فتبارك الله أحسن الخالقين.
On behalf of Qatar Foundation for Education, Science and Community Development, it is therefore an honor for me to stand before you today on what is a momentous occasion, not only for Sidra Medical and Research Center, but also for educational community development in our beloved country.
That was the opening night of Damien Hirst's The Miraculous Journey in Doha. Finally, the Al Riwak exhibition space is home to Relics, a huge new Damien Hirst retrospective or mid-career survey show that includes all of the British artist's greatest hits, as well as a handful of new works. Similar to last year's Tate Modern show, but not quite the same then. Curator Francesco Bonami pulled off a coup in getting private collectors to lend their priceless pieces. Well, perhaps there's always a price with Hirst. To be shipped to Qatar and was a dab hand at explaining the love and death in much of Hirst's work. Better than that, though, I enjoyed an audience with the artist himself to talk about looking back, the wonderful titles of his works, and why 1 + 1 = 3.
It's like a mathematical sum, isn't it? It's like, you know that 1 + 1 = 2. But I guess when you're making artwork and you're putting things together, you've got an idea that if you put something with something else, it's going to look good with a small g. But it's like when you put it together and it's like looks like 1 + 1 = 3, that's when it's like a great thing, you know. And or, you know, and when things go together and they look like never, they should have been together forever.
You get that feeling like it's when you hear a great song on the radio and you wonder how it's been done. You must have that. Yeah. You must have had that feeling a lot of times in the studio.
I think anything done well is art, and I think, you know, it's like, I think of that piece by Picasso where he put the bicycle seat with the handlebars to make the bull's head, and you think, oh my God, that moment must have been amazing, because it's like, you know, and, you know, it just constantly says, what does it mean? You don't know why it's good, but it looks great, and it's. So I suppose you're always looking for things like that. A lot of the time, it looks rubbish. And it goes in, you don't show it to anyone.
And I wonder whether you're tempted. You must be keen to know what people think. You obviously know what people think after so long, but whether you ever want to sneak into the private view, or more just on a kind of rainy Tuesday and wander around and hear what people are saying, whether in Doha or in London or wherever. Are you curious to know what people are thinking about?
I think very early on I looked at it, and you think, because I make work that, you know, I'd like people to get passionate about, and I'm very aware that they can be passionately against it as well as passionately for it. So I want to make work that you kind of can't forget, rather than work that you love. I mean, I don't expect everybody to love it. I mean, I think that'd be crazy.
Yeah.
But so very early on, I tried to not enjoy the good reviews so that then I could ignore the bad ones. But it's difficult sometimes. I mean, I put an outdoor sculpture into Devon, where I live. Yeah. She was a big pregnant lady. And first day when I went to look at it, there were loads of people around it. They didn't recognise me at all. But as I walked down, there was like a 14-year-old girl stood there, and just as I went past, I just heard her saying, oh my God, that's disgusting. So you think...
That was your fake beard she was talking about, your disguise.
Yeah, no, but you can't please everybody, but I think, you know, I mean, it's healthy debate, I like.
And I wonder whether your themes stay the same. I mean, we've been walked around by Francesco. He's a great talker about your stuff, obviously. And I wonder whether you feel that you can see a progression, or it all just comes from the same place. It just needs to be got out there, sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, my concerns have always been the same concerns, really, and it's just different ways of presenting it. I mean, I have a lot of opposing views, and I think in the beginning when I started off being an artist, I thought that was a problem. So I was thinking, like, it makes me think, maybe I don't know what I'm doing, because I do this and I do that. But then as soon as I just accepted that, then I could make all these different types of work. I mean, you know, all my shows sort of feel like a group show with lots of different artists, and they all live inside my head. But I think that's...
It's a good form of therapy, right? It's a big space for it.
Yeah, it's like therapy, yeah. I mean, it's good. But all the art, I mean, you know, every single piece could be a self-portrait or something.
The last thing we saw was 1,000 years and 100 years. And obviously some of the artists that inspired you loved that work yourself. Does that make any difference? I mean, aside from caring about what other people think or not caring, the respect to those painters must have been a big deal, right?
I think all the artists that I admire, or you know, even, you know, people I think who are successful, it's like they've always kind of managed to measure their own success in their own terms rather than other people's. So I think that's something you've really got to work hard at, because an artwork can be successful, but maybe people won't like it. But you know, it can still be successful in terms of what you're trying to achieve. So I think you've really got to sort of, you know, work out how to measure the right kind of success. So, I mean, throughout my career, I've always managed to do that, you know, and it's like when people, there's been moments when I've been surrounded by people who are telling me I'm brilliant, and I've tried to ignore that, so that you know that when they're all telling that you're less than brilliant, you can just carry on. I mean, Andy Warhol said some great quotes. He said, if everybody tells you that your paintings are no good, make more. And, you know, things like that. And I always, I mean, they're humorous, but I mean, I think they're great techniques. Or he said, don't read your reviews, you weigh them.
There's a skill in the aphorism, right, as well, the epigram. You've got to be...
Yeah, there is. I mean, I remember reading when I was young sort of interviews by artists and thinking, oh, my God, they're so smart. I could never say things like that. And then now sometimes people find a quote by me and lay it out and you go, did I say that? How did I say that? Yeah.
But that was a good party night, probably. That's when the good ones... That's maybe when the good ones come out.
They come out all the time. You definitely get some good ones when you're drunk, but you get some pretty good ones sober as well. And you also can get good ones from people mistranslating what you said.
Your titles, which have always been... We're talking of aphorisms and Warholisms and epigrams and stuff, always so strong. I wonder whether sometimes the titles come before the works.
It comes both ways round. I mean, I hated Untitled, that's for me in the beginning. It's like when I started making art, people were naming titles Untitled, and it so incensed me. I just thought that's so horrible. And especially like Untitled number one, Untitled number two. So I just thought you have to have a title. So then I just tried to think of verbal ways to say what the thing is saying visually. But you know, sometimes it works very well and other times it doesn't. But then as well, but now I end up with, you know, loads of lists of titles and loads of ideas, and I kind of chopping about with them.
That was me talking to Damien Hirst at the opening of Relics On at the Al Riwak Centre in Doha. For more information on the Qatar UK Year of Culture, just visit QatarUK2013.com. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. The TV industry's annual conference, sales market, networking events, and let's be honest, party, MIPCOM, wrapped in Cannes last week. This year, more than 13,000 participants from over 100 countries flew in for the five-day event, and there to cover it all was our pal Peter White, senior international reporter from Broadcast magazine. Fresh off the plane from Nice, he stopped by Midori House to tell us about this year's trends and what TV caught his BDI.
It was actually a really busy market this time, more so than the event in April that happens. And lots of Americans were in town, which gave it a bit of a buzz. The rest of the world seems to follow the Americans. So if there's lots of Americans in town, then the rest of the world seems to want to turn up. Because if the people are from Disney's and the Sony's all turn up, then they're sort of the really sort of...
They're following the names, they're following the cash, I guess, as
exactly.
Well, and the biggest nation of eyeballs.
They're following the money.
That's not a perfect metaphor, is it? The biggest nation of eyeballs, but you know what I mean.
Exactly.
I don't know if it's true that Americans have bigger eyeballs. I mean, that's essentially what I'm saying, and that's wrong.
There were more eyeballs, apart from the Chinese.
They do, yeah.
The other interesting is there was a lot of Chinese deals happening where you're selling... I mean, China's been historically really tough to get into, but a lot of people selling their shows into China. So a lot of people keen to sort of try and find money over there.
We're going to start with a Turkish show that's being remade in the US. It's called The End. Tell us a little bit about it.
No, I was very interested. This show has been in sort of going around the international market for a few years. Turkish drama up until recently has never travelled, and there's never been an example of an English-speaking country remaking a Turkish show with any success. So Fox announced earlier this week that they were going to remake the show. And it sounds great. I mean, we've seen a little bit of it, but it is essentially this woman thinks her husband has died in a plane crash, and then she finds out he hasn't, and he's been living a double life, and it's got a sort of element of 24 to it. It's you know, a little bit ridiculous, but you know, very much following that trend for fun but silly shows.
Aylin Hanım, yolcu listesinde eşinizin ismi görünmüyor. Bilet satışla görüştüm. Selim Karan adına kesilmiş bir bilet gözüküyor, ancak check-in işlemi gerçekleştirilmemiş.
Anlamadım.
Eşinizin ismi yolcu listemizde yok. Selim Karan adlı bir yolcu yok uçakta.
And that was a clip from The End, which is a Turkish series being remade in the US by Fox.
Yeah, so it'll be really interesting to see if it's a success, and therefore then Turkey will become the new Israel, or
right.
You know, the new Holland, or yeah. The new market that everyone scatters around looking for new ideas.
I mean, I liked in that clip the use of that sort of heartbeat sort of musical trope.
Yeah.
That means that it's all about sort of helicopter shots, panning shots. We go through airports,
exactly.
We go from mountaintops, we look down upon cities. I like that. That's what we need, right?
Exactly, very much
big
so.
Production values. Hi, I'm a TV show. I'm expensive.
Very expensive.
We're going to go up north next to Sweden. Yep. And it's called Welcome to Sweden, this show. We watched the clip. This looks genuinely rather amusing. What's the story behind this?
This is very funny. This is a very interesting and very international story. So there's a chap called Greg Poehler, who is an American and happens to be the brother of Amy Poehler, the Saturday Night Live mm-hmm. and Parks and Recreation comedian. And he moved. This is a genuine story, a real life tale of him moving to Sweden when he found this girl and they liked, and she was Swedish and she was moving back home. Anyway, he'd done a bit of stand-up before, but obviously when your sister is Amy Poehler, you start to think how you can turn that into perhaps a television series. So he partnered up with an American company and a Swedish broadcaster. So this is half in Swedish and half in English, but it's going to be a very fascinating show because, you and I, Rob, have talked before about Scandinavia still being, you know, this extremely fertile ground for television. So this will be funny. They've never really nailed the comedies internationally, so this will be interesting to see if it pans out.
And I suppose comedy, that is the sort of lost in translation meets love has no boundaries kind of thing. That's kind of the sort of comedy of the mishap.
It's the ultimate fish out of water story.
Yeah.
Who is Bruce?
I don't know how much Emma's told you, but
you left the big shot job, big career, you made lots of money, you had celebrity clients, then you moved to Sweden to live with our daughter.
Yep.
And that was some clips from Welcome to Sweden, a Swedish thing being remade.
Well, not even
it's actually this guy's sort of life story, isn't it? Or
exactly.
Part of his life story.
Exactly. It's a sort of a comedic version of his own story.
I like one part of the trail that we didn't hear there. It was the when he's lying on the analyst's couch. He's wondering if he's depressed.
Yeah.
He thinks he's depressed, and she goes, "No, you're just becoming more Swedish."
Exactly.
Which is presumably a nice joke. I presume that one will be in the first episode. Right?
And I presume that one's going to translate quite well in Sweden and elsewhere.
And lastly, we come to Act of Valor, without a U. This is a thing about US Navy SEALs, and it's based not on real life events, but on actual events.
Yeah, the most interesting apparently. Bit of this is a movie that came out a couple of years ago. And this is sort of, I highlighted this because it's part of an interesting trend. It used to be always the case that the movie business was the biggest business in entertainment, and you know, TV was very secondary, and it's now to the point where TV has become so much more important than film. So now you're getting these film companies, whether it's Jeffrey Katzenberg at DreamWorks, or in this case, Relativity is run by a guy called Ryan Kavanagh, this incredibly young and successful film producer, who's decided to take the movies that he's already made, things like Act of Valor and Limitless, which was had Bradley Cooper in it, and turn them into TV series. It's only just started happening in the last couple of years, so we'll see if it continues. But it certainly looks to be that television has taken over the impetus of film, and you're going to start getting people that would have maybe made movies now making TV shows.
We're going to have a clip from this because you'll probably tell from this clip that this does feature rugged men unblinkingly walking away from explosions.
Yeah.
Live your life by a code. It's your shoreline. It's what guides you home. And trust me, you're always trying to get home.
That was Act of Valor, starring Peter White and Robert Bounds, the two hardest nuts in the US Navy SEALs, right?
It's a big long anger for the US Navy SEALs, exactly. It's, you know, it's utterly ridiculous. There's lots of explosions, and it's absolutely wonderful.
And I just wondered, is there still a lot of goodwill for that sort of show about a sort of swashbuckling American military heroes going in and sorting out the sort of parts of the world that need sorting out? Is there still sort of goodwill towards that? Are there any boos and hisses in the audience when these things are screened.
There might be certain places you're not going to sell it, but they're probably very few. I think that people do still like that. There is still this silly attachment to those. It comes out of Hollywood, and people love Hollywood. But yeah, look, Swashbuckling was certainly one of the themes. There was a lot of shows about pirates. There was a British show called Moonfleet, which stars Ray Winstone, about pirates and swashbuckling. And there was an American show by Michael Bay, another film director, from Transformers, who's making a pirate show called Black Sails. So yeah, swashbuckling is generally a theme at MIPCOM this year.
That was Peter White, senior international reporter for Broadcast, talking to me there. We're off to get matching tattoos later. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Next up, we'll be discussing the stunning new film about the life and work of Tim Hetherington. Stay tuned.
When is a shop more than just a shop? Monocle visits three bricks and mortar businesses offering unique products and impeccable service in Toronto, Paris, and in Madrid.
The fascinating thing about spices is spices actually are a bit of the history of the opening up of the world, because different spices will tell you a little bit about where people went and what they brought back, and it's fascinating when you actually follow any spice.
Trader's Secrets revealed in our Monocle briefing film, Spotlighting Retail, in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. There's something infuriating about photojournalist Tim Hetherington's death in Libya in 2011. Granted, he covered wars for a living, but he wasn't interested in the fighting, as he clearly explained when winning the World Press Photo of the Year in 2007 for his work in Afghanistan's Korangal Valley. His work documented more intimate moments aside from the front line. In a new film, Which Way is the Front Line from Here?, war reporter Sebastian Junger, a close friend of Hetherington's who co-directed the Oscar-nominated documentary Restrepo with him, tries to explain the reasons for his death and paints the portrait of a man who affected the world in a unique manner with his craft. Junger and war reporter James Brabazon, another close friend of Hetherington's and the producer of the film, met with Monocle's Daphne Denis at Midori House.
Tim, he didn't see a division between being photographer or journalist or humanitarian. He was just Tim.
Walking around with him was almost like walking around with a set of 10 eyes. He was always so inspired.
Belief in photography is that it's about engaging with people. And he had a way of being able to do that that was remarkable.
Quite soon after Tim's death in Misrata, I decided to interview the people who were the other journalists who were with him when he died. He was hit by mortar fragments from a round fired by Gaddafi forces. The other journalists were coming to New York for his memorial service. I thought I would interview them just to find out what happened. And then I thought, okay, I'll interview them with a video camera, just, I might as well. Within days, I decided to try to assemble all this into a film.
And James, at which point did you join in this project?
He got in touch and asked me if I'd like to come on board. And it just seemed to fit really well, I sort of knew Tim personally very well and had started filming with him at the beginning of his career. And Sebastian had done, an awful lot of work with Tim later on in his career. So in a sense, our experiences of Tim bookended each other.
Tim was quite a confusing character. He was a lot of things. He was an artist. He did video. He did photographs. He was a journalist as well. What was the picture that you were trying to convey here, Sebastian?
Well, his public identity was formed by his experiences in combat. He was working on what draws young men to war. They're not just subjected to it by, the older generation of males. They're actually drawn to it. And Tim was very engaged with that sort of confusing question. I wanted the film to be about that as well, because, of course, Tim didn't necessarily have to go out to a front line, but he was drawn to it the way young men are drawn to combat, and it killed him.
It's true that your film works on sort of two levels here. You have, obviously, the story of war and young men at war, but then Tim is a young man at war himself. Do you think that Tim was somewhat addicted to war?
What's really key to remember about Tim's work is that he wasn't interested in documenting war and combat for the sake of it. If you look at a lot of his best work, especially the work that was done in the Korangal Valley, and look at the book Infidel that was produced out of work while being on assignment with Sebastian, there are very, very few weapons in that book. It's a book of photographs about people. What Tim's interested in is the software of war, not the pornography of war. He's interested in the people who fight, why they fight, and how it affects them. So yes, there's that very strong pull towards war and towards being in and filming combat. But actually, what distinguishes Tim from a lot of other perhaps more classical combat reporters, is where he points his camera and why.
Tim's career starts in Liberia and ends in Libya. And it seems really out of character for Tim to go to Libya. He's someone who stayed years and years in Africa, then went to Afghanistan and stayed for a really long time as well. He's someone who embedded with people, who wanted to connect with people. Why did he go there? Sebastian?
I think partly he missed combat. I think it was unnerving for him to be sort of sequestered in the United States, attending to our film Restrepo and the Oscars and all that, while the Arab Spring was exploding and world history was changing. And we were journalists, and we couldn't do our work because we were back home. So we had an assignment from Vanity Fair to cover the Arab Spring, specifically Libya. And, you know, he couldn't wait to get out of there, out of the U.S.
Tim's last diary entries in Misrata before he was killed are quite an interesting insight into the work that he was doing and why. You know, he went once briefly to Libya, and then when the assignment didn't work out with Sebastian, he then went back without a commission. I mean, he was working unassigned in Libya when he was killed. And you can see from his diary that what he's looking at is this idea of truth and beauty. Is it possible to compose pictures at war which are both beautiful and also true? And what is the purpose and meaning of creating a beautiful image in conflict? So I think that, you know, right back to your original question about Tim was quite a confusing character, I think he quite reveled in that confusion, and he quite enjoyed bucking against what people wanted him to be. When he accepted his World Press Photo Prize for the work he did in the Corangal Valley, at his acceptance speech he said, "I'm not really interested in photography." I think what he was interested in were the ideas that he was exploring through different media. And in Libya, he was looking at, again, this arc of how young men at war see themselves and why, and also exploring this notion of beauty versus truth.
My last question is, again, to both of you. When you work with someone as a journalist, you learn something. What would you say that you've learned with Tim?
I mean, I have to say he really opened my eyes to something about the world that I had been missing. When we were at Restrepo, this outpost, there was a lot of combat. If you don't think like Tim does, it's easy to think that combat is the point of what's going on out there, and your job as a journalist is to document that combat. And pretty quickly, he said, I remember him saying to me, you know, I've realized the just about the least interesting thing about combat is combat. There's much more interesting things going on out here. There's the emotional reality out here. There's the relationship between the men. And the ultimate form that that was expressed in some ways was he did this photo series of them all asleep. And he said, you know, you see these soldiers in their gear with their guns, but that's not really who they are. I mean, they take that stuff off and they go to sleep and then they turn into little boys. And that's the ultimate sort of truth about war, is that it's fought by little boys. And you finally see that when they're asleep. That was Tim. You know, that was how he thought about the world. It was a completely unique vision, and I learned an enormous amount from him.
A lot of things. I think principally that when you're working, keep both eyes open and keep smiling.
The reality of war isn't that you might get killed out there. The core truth about war is that you're guaranteed to lose your brothers.
Sebastian Junger and James Brabazon talking to Monocle's Daphne Denny there. Which Way Is the Front Line From Here has been doing the rounds internationally and is out in UK cinemas now. Still to come in part two, Mashru Leila provides some more musical entertainment from their Midori House session. We sit down with the director of the Festival du Nouveau Cinéma in Montreal and attend the first edition of Flip Brazil's sister events in the UK. Music, film, books and capoeira. What more could you need in life? First up is Hamed Sino, the gay lead singer and co-founder of the Lebanese seven-member rock band Mashru Leila. From his sexuality to the band's satirical lyrics and controversial themes, the group have been making more than sound waves. Georgina Godwin caught up with Hamed in the studio after their Midori House session. But first up, here they are with Lil Watan. استتشرق بسؤال عن تدهور الأحوال يسكتوك بشعارات عن كل مؤامرات وانوك القطيع
Bashir Leila was formed at the American University in Beirut. You're all design and architecture students.
Mm-hmm.
How did it come together?
Well, we all came from certain musical backgrounds. Some of us had received formal training. Some of us were just amateur musicians. And we really liked music and we didn't have so much time to do it anymore. So we started this workshop for architecture and design students because our schedules were comparable. And it went from there.
And it's something that's very much reflected still in your music?
I think in terms of having a designer's sensibility about how we approach stuff, yeah, even the way we argue about things, you know, we very rarely end up arguing about things in terms of like, does this actually resolve musically or is this dissonant in a bad way or anything like that? A lot of times it's like, is this too pastiche? Is this too referential? Is whatever. We think like designers in how we approach stuff.
Insofar as the Arab Spring goes, how far has your music been affected or has it affected events that have happened in your country?
I think the way it works with culture and politics is that whether you're looking at music or whether you're looking at upheavals on the street or you know, people picketing, I think we're all produced by, you know, time and place in an interesting way where there's a certain number of, you know, changing power relations and power matrices in the region that are affecting, you know, people's political consciousnesses and at the same time affecting their cultural sort of oscillations. So I think we're very much produced by the same thing. I don't think there's a necessarily causal relationship between, you know, cultural production and politics in that kind of way. I think they both come from the same stuff.
But the content of your songs often quite satirical, quite controversial. Mm-hmm. What sort of issues are you addressing in your music?
Honestly, I mean, we never get into the music room and start writing with the intention of we're complaining about something or talking about a social issue or whatever. That's never really a primary concern for us. It's always just to make music. But then these things often, you know, end up being the stuff that we're actually moved by. So that ends up influencing us. You know, I think everyone in the band is sort of very affected by the political situation across the region. We all have political aspirations, whether they're in line or not. We all have, you know, social expectations that we'd like to negotiate and stuff. But whether we intend on doing that through music or just in our everyday life is a whole other ballgame, I guess.
Have you faced much censorship?
Honestly, no. We don't really play in Middle Eastern countries where there's a lot of censorship that's expected. There's some sensitivity about cursing in some of our lyrics.
Because you do swear quite a lot.
I mean, you know, I did when I was younger, I'll tell you that much. I was much angrier. We don't do that so much anymore. But with the earlier stuff, we'd often get asked to not, you know, use those words on stage. So we once tried to like actually mess around with the lyrics so that we go with rhymes or whatever. But then afterwards, I mean, what we've been doing is just like, I'll go quiet then and just have the audience sing it, at which point I can't really, you know, take the blame for any of that, which is fair enough.
Do you feel that there's quite a lot of pressure on your shoulders as perhaps a group that a whole generation of young Arabic speakers are looking to represent them, particularly in this incredibly potent political climate?
Look, I won't lie to you. It's a lot of pressure, especially when you get out there and you meet people and you're constantly confronted with the fact that that is an expectation. But I think for all of us, it was a big source of stress for a while, and then we just like. At some point, you need to let go of these things. It becomes impossible to like actually be productive if you're going to wake up and think, how am I going to please, you know, that many people? So essentially what we end up doing is we just go back to where we started, at which point we're just making music for each other and ourselves. And we just write about what actually affects us instead of trying to write about what's going to please that many people. If that blows over well, then great. And if it doesn't, then, you know, wrong time, wrong place, wrong people, perhaps.
That was Hamed Sino talking to Georgina Godwin. Mahshu Layla's new album Ra'a Souk is out now, and we'll be hearing one more track from the band at the end of the show. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Now to Canada, where the 42nd edition of the Festival du Nouveau Cinéma kicked off in Montreal last week, screening more than 300 fresh films from around the world. Alongside the latest offerings by emerging homegrown talent, also on the agenda during the 12-day festival are music gigs and industry-focused gatherings. Our Toronto bureau chief, Nelly Godcheva, met with the festival director, Nicolas Girard-Deltruc, to chat about the state of Montreal's film market and the highlights from this year's event.
Each year, like, we show like an average of 300 films. I think that this year is going to be like 273 films, but it's like including feature films, short films, but we also have a lot of other activities around those films, because for us it's very important to be like different than a regular theater. So we organize, because it's a festival, something which is like a huge party during like 11 days, with a concert, conference, masterclass, and also we have a new event this year. We're gonna have four exterior projections for free.
And it is the 42nd edition of the festival. How many people come here usually per year?
It's almost like 100,000 visitors per year.
And you also told me, just because you're not only showing films, but you have a lot of industry-focused events organized during the festival. And I guess a lot of professionals and industry insiders are also coming. So can you tell me more about the special events that you have organized?
So, of course, there is a lot of activities where a lot of professionals can meet, you know, each other and talk about, you know, project or about, you know, how is the industry now. But we have another event which is really more focused on industry, more focused on new technology and new media. And people who come for this event, you know, will talk about a new project, web series, mini series, new diffusion. And those people came from the United States, Europe. So it's an event to stimulate a lot of co-production and collaboration.
And talking about the industry and the state of the market, how is Montreal doing in this direction? What is your take on the film industry in Montreal, in Quebec, and even in Canada as a whole?
I think that we are here in Quebec in a very specific market. Of course, there is a very important specificity in terms of production. This is the reason why, you know, each year you can see in the most important film festival in the world a very important selection of Quebec film. For example, you know, we can talk about Locarno, where, you know, the film Gabrielle received a very, very beautiful coverage by the public and by the press. Gabrielle is also like the film who has been selected for the Oscar to represent, you know, Canada.
Gabrielle, as-tu touché au pénis de Martin?
Non, j'ai pas touché à son pénis.
Son pote.
Do you think that there is an international market for those films, for films that are made in Quebec?
I think yes, and there is a lot of them who are released outside Quebec. And maybe more than other Anglophone films from Canada. And also some of them, I think, have been released in Scandinavia, because I think that there is something very close in terms of philosophy or in terms of, I don't know, mentality.
And also you do have a special section of films made in Quebec and Canada this year. So what are the highlights this year?
And in fact, you know, we created this section, I think, 5 years ago. It's a special section dedicated to Canadian cinema, Quebec and Canadian. It's called like Focus Quebec Canada, with at least between 15 and 20 films. You know, it was really important for us, because we live in Canada, to show, you know, what is the best. For example, there is Gerontophilia, you know, made by Bruce LaBruce, Diego Star by Frédéric Pelletier, and Guillaume Sylvestre, Sébastien Landry, Jeff Barnaby, who are in this section.
The inspectors and officers of immigration will want to speak to you. You will tell them that you don't know nothing.
That was Nicolas Gérard Del Truc talking to Nelly Gotcheva. Montreal's Festival du Nouveau Cinéma runs in the city until the 20th of October. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Off to Brazil next, via a rural town in England called Snape Maltings.
Join Monocle's editors every weekday at 8 a.m. for The View from Midori House. We'll be setting the day's agenda with special guests in the studio and from our bureaus around the world.
The opposition needs to identify the key message to deliver to their niche. And their niche is the 60% of the population who's voting for Korea right now.
We'll check in with our editors on the road, whether they're snowbound or sun-kissed. And of course, we'll still have the focus on music, media and the arts that you've come to expect. That's Midori House, every weekday at 8 a.m. London time.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Founded in 2003 by Liz Calder in the scenic city of Paraty on the coast of Rio de Janeiro State, Flip Festival put Brazil on the literary map. Attracting world-class roster of writers alongside the cream of Brazil's homegrown talent, the event has been running successfully every July ever since. Now, Calder, herself a Brit, has decided to bring the festival a bit closer to home. Just over a week ago, the first edition of Flipside took place in Snape Maltings, a small town near England's east coast, some 6,000 miles away from the original fair. We sent our Brazilian researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco along to its inaugural edition to see whether his nation's writing has found a new home in the UK.
Snape Maltings is normally home to classical music concerts, but this weekend there is a slightly different atmosphere. Brazilian samba lingers in the background, and people can be heard chatting Portuguese as well as English. Walking around, you might forget for a moment that you're in deepest rural England. The smell of delicious traditional Brazilian cuisine wafts across the space, while capoeiristas show off their movements. Founder Liz Calder explained why she brought her festival to England.
Yes, that seems like a mad idea, but all I know is, and it's partly to do not just with the authors, who I thought deserved to be better known, but also that the music that made me fall in love with Brazil, I thought if you get people who can really interpret bossa nova and samba in the right way in which it is, and not like it's made for the consumer overseas, so it's the kind of stuff you hear in the airports and lifts, that would make people fall in love with it like I did.
Rio-born author Adriana Lisboa is launching her new novel here at Flipside. Crow Blue focuses on dislocation, exile, and the search for lost parents.
There's sort of two main plots going on in the book. One of them is a young girl, a Brazilian girl, whose mother suddenly dies. She's 13, and she goes to the United States to look for her biological father. And in this process, her help in the United States is her mother's ex-husband, not her father, but her mother's ex-husband, who was a guerrilla in times of the military dictatorship in Brazil. He was a guerrilla in the Araguaia guerrilla in the Amazon. So the story of the guerrilla is more or less told in the book as well.
It wouldn't be a Brazilian event without football and music. Alex Belus is author of Futebol, The Brazilian Way of Life. He's giving a talk on why Brazilians are so connected with football.
The importance of football in Brazil is different, and I'd say more important than football is to any other country, because football forms part of the identity of Brazil in a way that it doesn't form the identity of any other country. And to understand this, you need to understand a little bit about the history of Brazil. Brazil received more slaves than any other country, black African slaves, than 6 times more than America, for example, and abolished slavery later, only right at the end of the 19th century. So it is defined by its racial mixture. At the beginning of the 20th century, there were lots of racist theories and this feeling in Brazil that it was never going to work as a country because of its racial problems. And then in the 1930s, all of a sudden, people started to think, or the Brazilians started to think, that this new identity, actually, it is our mixture which makes us great. And what was the greatest example of what made, of what represented the greatness of this mixture? It was success in football.
As the weekend draws to a close, David Tris, professor of Portuguese at King's College London and author of Brazilian Jive, From Samba to Bossa and Rap, explains why Brazilian music is a subject worth writing about.
Other countries are no doubt comparable to it, but it's very special, it's very central. I mean, some people would say, well, this is because Brazil has low literacy rates, it's a less literate culture. I think that's a kind of negative way of understanding the problem. I think we have to understand that music has been central to so many cultural traditions and to the community life of so many people coming from, not just from the world of African culture or Amerindian culture, but also from all of the immigrant communities that have fueled Brazil's kind of modern profile in the 20th century. And I think music is the common denominator, if you like.
This won't be the only flip side. Liz Calder has announced that it's going to be an annual event, a welcome new addition to the busy Literally Festival calendar in the UK. The main difference here is that you can enjoy listening to Chico Buarque while sipping a caipirinha, which can only be a good thing. For Monaco, with one foot in Snape Maltings and the other in Paraty, I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be popping into some of the satellite exhibitions around Frieze Art Fair. We'll get the lowdown on this year's CMJ Music Marathon in New York. And ever thought about investing in a Picasso? Let us be your guide. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, as always produced by Katie Bilboa, who was assisted by the brilliant Holly Fisher. And as always, we have time for one final highlight from this week's Midori House session. Dubbed the best session we ever had, this is Mashru Leila with Bacher. Thanks, as ever, for tuning in.
Oh, yeah. pleasure, a show.